This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We've all seen images created by an electron microscope. Could be a close-up of the honeycomb texture of a fly's eye magnified millions of times, or perhaps the curved and spiraled bacteria that inhabit your gut. You know, the photos draw you in with their minute details, but they all have one thing missing. What's that? Color. Yeah, they're always, have you noticed, they're always black and white images. Makes you wonder what those photos might look like in color. Well, researchers wondered that too. Nick Stockton is here to fill us in on that story and other selected short subjects in science. He's a science reporter for Wired, based out of San Francisco. Joins us from KQED Studios. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira.
So, Nick, answer the question. Why are electron microscope images always in black and white?
This is really fascinating. So I didn't know this before I started reporting the story, but these things get so small that they are too small for light to resolve. So photons are just too big, either the photon itself or the wave, whatever you want to think of it as, because, you know, they're just basically the same thing. It's just too big to resolve that image at that small. You know, it kind of breaks down at about 0.2 micron or micrometers, which is about 1/1000th the breadth of a strand of hair. So beyond that, light really doesn't work. It doesn't diffract. So you have to use electrons, which are much smaller. But those don't pick up spectral information, which is what we get color from. They only pick up like shape and texture and contours and stuff like that.
You know, we have images from planets. When we take pictures of planets that are sort of false color images, can't we fill in the color on an electron microscope the same sort of way?
Not in the same sort of way, but there are workarounds. And what these researchers did is they kind of created like a hack in some sort of way where, so you do not understand what they did. You kind of got to understand what the normal electron microscope process looks like. And what they do at first is they treat whatever specimen they want to look like with a type of heavy metal, like a lead or something like that, because electrons like to bounce off that stuff. But then they found by using these like rare earth exotic metals like lanthanides, which are what they also use to make lithium ion batteries out of, they can make special formulations of lanthanides that will only stick to certain molecules. And so they say they want to look at, you know, a certain peptide going through a neuronal synapse or something, or a type of virus. They will concoct a lanthanide that will only stick to those. And so they first make that grayscale base layer using the heavy metals, clean that off, and then treat the sample once again with this special picky lanthanide that's only going to stick to this one kind of molecule. And then they treat it again, and then they come back, and they just kind of assign a color to that. It's not the actual color of the thing that they're looking at, but it helps them do detective work on the images they're looking at, so they can pick out, like, oh, okay, this is where all this virus is, or, oh, these are all the neuronal synapses we want to track.
So it helps them pick out the detail that they couldn't see before.
Exactly. Exactly.
Let's move on to the New Horizons flyby. Pluto made that last year and sent some amazing images, speaking about images. It's still buffering, though? It's still downloading, sending back to Earth some of those images?
It's actually just finished. Last week, on October 25th, they sent home their last little batch of data. And it took 15 months. They were downloading at about a rate of 1,200 bits per second, which is really slow.
It's the old modem days.
It's the old modem days, exactly. But they had to do it over 3 billion miles of deep space. So give them kind of a little slack on that.
Mm-hmm. So they're finished. Everything is done.
It's all in. Yeah, they got home 6.25 gigabytes, and it was pretty interesting process. Like they had to. I was speaking with Alice Bowman about it, and she's the operations manager for the New Horizons project. And she explained to me that they did this. There were 500 data drops they did over the course of 15 months, and each one was an 8-week process of setting up, trying to figure out or not trying to figure out what they knew this stuff was, but they had to index every little bit of data by the time code from when the New Horizons spacecraft became active. So they had to say, like, okay, we want the piece of data that was collected at, you know, 342,265,863 seconds after New Horizons left Earth, and the probe was tilted, you know, X degrees this way, Y degrees that way, and the RALF imager was on, or the LORI imager was on, and they get a piece of data back, and, you know, at the time, they didn't know what these things were going to have. They just knew it was going to be aimed at what Newtonian physics told them where Pluto would be. And then they got them back, and we get these wonderful things like ice volcanoes and, you know, a giant, beautiful heart on the front of New Horizons. And they did this, you know, this process of figuring out what these things were and running simulations on it and having engineers double check and make sure that this is going to get the data that they want and this is the priority data they need. And they got it all home safely, which is pretty remarkable.
Good. Yeah, that's good. Let's move on to California, right, where you are now. California is known for earthquakes. We, of course, you know that. But researchers are reexamining, I understand, a few historic ones. Tell us about that.
Right. So this pair of USGS geologists based in Pasadena came across a bunch of old drilling data from the early 1900s. Back when LA wasn't the sprawling metropolis you know it now, it was, you know, still kind of a city, but it was one of the heaviest oil producing regions in the world at the time, especially around Huntington Beach. If you see photographs in the era, there's just like a forest of derricks. Mm-hmm. And they found these records that people had forgotten about that had exact drilling data, like depth and location for these. And they started correlating that to some big, relatively big earthquakes that happened around that time, particularly one that happened in March of 1933, which killed 120 people. And they, by correlating the drill depth and stuff like that, they came to the hypothesis that these oil drilling operations might have caused that earthquake and not just normal fault line pressures.
So we're talking about fracking 100 years ago. Almost causing earthquakes.
Yeah, similar. So the reason they started doing this is because of the earthquakes that are happening in Oklahoma, and those aren't from fracking; they're from wastewater injection. But same kind of process. You're putting extra stress on the fault line that didn't exist before.
Mm-hmm. And so this has been going on longer than we thought. Right. These earthquakes caused by reinjecting that water back down there.
Right. Well, this is a little bit different. What they did differently was they were actually just sucking a bunch of oil out without putting anything back in there. And it was creating this what's called subsidence, and it creates this kind of pressure on the fault. And that caused the faults to slip. And since, you know, later in the decades since like that happened, they will put more water down into the well to create kind of a balance on the fault. Well, actually to get more oil out of it, but the benefit is it balances out the fault, so we don't get these kinds of earthquakes anymore in Southern California.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting. That's really good. Thanks, Nick. Nick Stockton joining us for Wired Magazine based out of San Francisco. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Excellent. Thank you, Ira.
You're welcome. And now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. And if you own a car, chances are, right, it's just sitting there parked a good deal of the time. Maybe it's sitting in your driveway. Maybe you parked at your workplace. So what about letting other people rent out your car if you're not using it? This week, Toyota announced the trial of a gadget that would let you give other people, the ability to use a cell phone to unlock and start your car. Tesla's Elon Musk has said that car sharing, especially of self-driving cars, is a big part of that company's strategy. Here to run through the good and the bad around personal car sharing services is Andrew Hawkins. He's a transportation reporter at The Verge, and he's here in our New York studios. Welcome, Andrew.
Hey.
All right, the good thing about this.
Well, the good thing is that, like you mentioned, majority of part of the time, our vehicles are just sitting there useless and not doing anything. They're in a parking spot, they're in a driveway, they're in a garage, and they're just wasting space. So the theory behind all of this would be a greater utilization of this vehicle by allowing other people to come in and take it for a trip when they need to go buy groceries, to run errands. The question is, do you trust these people to use your vehicle? So we've seen a lot of car companies getting into this business, Toyota, BMW, Ford, GM, they're all sort of interested in this car sharing industry because they see this as a hedge against the idea that in the future people will be less interested in owning their own car and more interested in taking Uber or Lyft, for instance, and ride sharing or in car sharing and sort of borrowing each other's cars or maybe having one car for a whole building or one car for a couple families or a group of friends to all use together. So it's kind of a radical idea, but it's been around for a while. Zipcar, obviously, is a business that's been around for a long time.
So the bad news, then, is who wants to lend their car to a stranger, right?
That you do have to sort of be very trusting of strangers. Indeed, there's not a lot of peer-to-peer car sharing going on right now, but there are some small startups that are starting to get into it. This company called Get Around in San Francisco just received a heavy investment from a fund that's controlled by Toyota, and that's part of this car sharing investment that Toyota is trying to get involved in. And they created as part of this gadget called the Smart Key Box. And it's the sort of flat gray box that goes on your dashboard or inside your glove compartment. And it works via Bluetooth. So it allows people who have the right code on their phone to come and unlock the car using the app on their phone and then also start the car as well.
But the insurance companies will have to get on board with this, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, if you're going to give your car to someone else.
Absolutely. You don't want to be liable for somebody else's mistake for a number of reasons. So, yes, there will have to be new sort of financial products, new insurance products created around this whole idea. And there are a couple of insurance companies that are getting on board, but we haven't yet seen sort of widespread adoption.
So Tesla and the other car companies are saying, we don't want to sell cars to Uber. We want to become Uber.
Absolutely. Cars. There's an aspect of competition to this. Elon Musk, a couple weeks back, announced a sort of a new phase in his manufacturing process where all his new cars will be self-driving cars. And as part of that, part of the fine print in purchasing one of these cars is, oh, you can use these cars for ride sharing or for car sharing, but not for another business, not for something, not for Uber, not for Lyft. We want you to be able to do that within the Tesla's network.
Gotcha.
So it's about proprietary technology and making sure that the money is being spent towards Tesla's bottom line as opposed to somebody else's.
This is rapidly changing, isn't it? We'll keep coming back, Andrew, okay?
Sounds good.
Andrew Hawkins, transportation reporter at The Verge. We're going to take a break, and after we come back, we're going to jump into the world of jumping spiders. I didn't know about this. This is really interesting stuff. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. You know, certain animals capture our imagination. Maybe it's their mastery of mimicry or their ability to blend into their surroundings. Some are able to solve problems that seem too complicated for such a little creature. That description fits an animal I am thinking of. Any guesses? If you're thinking the octopus or any of the cephalopod cousins, good guesses. Here's a hint.
Spider-Man, Spider-Man, does whatever a spider can. Spins a web any size, catches thieves just like flies. Look out! Here comes the Spider-Man.
Ah, yes, Spider-Man. That's the great hint because I'm talking about jumping spiders, the spiders that jump just like Spider-Man does, who jumps and pounces on his prey. And here to explain and expound is Paul Shamble, a science fellow at Harvard University. He joins us from the studios on the campus there. Welcome to Science Friday.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thank you.
Jumping spiders. You know, I see them crawling around everywhere. They're like weaving webs and stuff like that. I mean, there are jumping spiders. Do we see them?
Yeah. No. You know, typically when we think about spiders, we all sort of have this imagination of like the Charlotte's web spider, right?
Yeah.
The one that makes the beautiful orb webs that live in your backyard and those kinds of things. But it turns out there's this whole other class of spiders, these guys that just sort of wander around and they don't weave capture webs at all. Instead, they have to actually sort of hunt down their prey.
So they act just like Spider-Man. They just jump around on them.
Yep, exactly. And so jumping spiders are in this category. They're these guys that are just really, really active predators.
They must have great vision, right? Be able to look around them and jump on their prey.
Yeah, exactly. That's really their sort of claim to fame. If you see zoomed in photos of them, they have these great, big, enormous eyes. And They're sort of one of the premier examples of a specialized visual creature.
Can you give us an idea how their eyes work?
Yeah, sure. So it's absolutely spectacular. So your eye has to sort of do a couple different things. You have a retina in the center that has really, really high resolution vision. And then the rest of your eye, sort of the resolution gets worse and worse as you get to the edges. And so all that is built into one thing. And with spiders in general have 8 eyes. And so for jumping spiders, each eye has become specialized to do a different thing. And so they have a pair of eyes that basically point backwards and tell them if there's danger coming. They have a pair of eyes that point up and do more or less the same thing. And then they have 4 eyes that point forwards. And so they have these 2 sort of on the outside, on the sides, that are essentially like your peripheral vision. They are really, really excellent at motion detection and things like that. And then they have these 2 eyes in the center that are just absolutely amazing. They're like a retina. They're movable. They have a 4-tiered retina. So they have 4 layers of retina in a row.
Wow.
That seems to be capable of calculating depth through one eye alone, through image defocusing. And they have color vision. And so it ends up with this. Their field of view is like 300 degrees.
Wow.
And they have
wow. They
have this visual resolution that is better than lots and lots of vertebrates, better than toads, better than lizards, all kinds of things.
So they must have their brains must be different then to process all this information.
Yeah. This is one of the things that's really special about them is that they just seem absolutely awash in information. I mean, they can also perceive vibratory information, and they can hear. We now know, but all this goes into a brain that we think has fewer neurons than a fruit fly,
wow.
And so somehow their brain seems to have they seem to have come up with some way that they can really, really handle just a ton of information.
Now I understand that jumping spiders have been taught some complex behaviors. You can train a spider.
Yeah, so they are amazingly intelligent animals. You can do sort of simple things, like if you show them a little video, like on your iPhone, they will attack it if they think it's prey, and they'll leave it alone if they don't.
Oh, come on.
And it gets worse, depending on how you think about it. It gets more impressive than that. They can solve 3D mazes. So if you set up a little thing and you put like a couple sticks on a table or something, and you put a fly at the top of one of them, They'll look at this scene and they can figure out which route they're going to have to take in order to get to the fly, which seems sort of simple until you think about how much visual information goes into that decision, like whether you go left to climb that stick or if you go right, and whether the whole maze connects or not. So they're just they're really, really amazing creatures.
Yeah, you hinted at before their ability to hear sounds, but they don't have ears.
Yeah, so this is some work that I did just recently with Gil Menda and a really wonderful team at Cornell University and Professor Ron Hoy's lab. What it comes down to is that spiders have these sensory hairs. Like you said, they don't have ears at all. The way that spiders detect what we would call sound, and physics-wise, this gets a little bit confusing because our ears detect pressure differences, and their hairs detect the actual particle movement.
Right.
And so when you make a sound, both those things happen, but the interaction and sort of the connection between them is pretty complex. So it turns out that we were sort of drastically underestimating the ways in which this worked in sort of the real world.
Wow. How do you test it out?
Very carefully.
My favorite answer.
Yeah, I'm sure. There's a lot of things that are kind of tricky about working with spiders. They're so good at detecting vibrations that if you just put a big speaker next to them, you run the risk of just shaking the table. And so you think that they're hearing it through the air, but really they're actually feeling it through the ground. So we sort of had to do a lot of experiments on to kind of get around that problem. But really what it comes down to is you put a speaker in a room, and in this case, you either observe behavior, or we also did recordings from their brains.
So you walk around the room clapping, does it react, or go outside and bang the door, that kind of
thing?
Yeah,
you know, that's how this whole project started. My colleague Gil Menda was, we were doing this other paper, and it was about vision, and one day, Gil set up an animal to do the recording, and he went to a slightly different part of the brain with the recording, and he squeaked his chair against the ground, and the way the lab is set up, you could hear the neurons fire whenever you get neural activity. So he squeaked his chair, and the neurons fired, and he sort of sat there for a second.
Wow.
And he backed the chair up again, and it squeaked again, and that was, you know, after a sort of afternoon of clapping and being amazed, we then sort of had to go on and, you know, turn it into real science.
That squeaky serendipitous moment has to go down in the annals of science.
It certainly has in our tiny corner of the world, yeah.
We've been talking about that jumping spiders and how they're built to be hunters, but even the biggest meat lover wants a few veggies now and then, right? My next guest observed a species of spider taking, well, let's say a sort of a salad break. Eric Olson is a senior lecturer in ecology at Brandeis University in Waltham, Massachusetts. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira. Thanks so much for having me on.
You're welcome. Tell us about, I understand you were out in the field and you observed a spider feeding on the plant. Was it munching on the leaves there?
No. So this is another case of serendipity. I got to give a shout out to Earthwatch. You know, the Earthwatch volunteers that come and help scientists in the field. As part of a sort of a side project to my main project in northwestern Costa Rica, I had these volunteers beating with the beating sheets, just collecting jumping spiders. They're beautiful animals, and as Paul was saying, they're really smart and elegant little critters. And we had an artist on board who was helping us make this nice catalog of the jumping spiders. And my volunteers actually brought in a spider we'd never seen before after several years of doing this inventory. And I said, wow, where'd you find that? And they said, it was on an ant acacia. Now, the ant acacia is a tree that's covered in stinging ants. And the ants help the plant by defending it. And the plant prepares the food for the ants. And all the food of the ant colony comes from the tree. And the really spectacular food are these little yellow pellets on the tips of the new leaves. And what it turned out, after a couple of years of my disbelief, you know, I finally said, okay, this spider keeps turning up on this ant acacia. We'd better go see what the heck it's doing. And so by observing this spider, we found that it was actually stealing the ant's food, the pellets that the plant was making as ant food. So it is a spectacular example of kind of the behavioral plasticity of these wee little predators that they took to eating plant tissue.
Is that make it easier for them than saying, instead of saying, hey, let's go jump around and find my own food, let's just take their food?
Well, it must be the case that it favored this phenomenon, because now we've collected over 1,100 jumping spiders of various species in this park. And we have never found this spider on any other plant except ant acacia. It seems to be a spider with a host plant. And so, you know, it's really a bizarre story, and there's a lot of unanswered questions still. Like, how does it get around? But your question about favoring this behavior, once it's on the plant, remember, the ants keep everybody else off. And so it's a kind of a safe haven. There's no other spiders. There's no praying mantises that might eat a spider. Birds don't even come to this plant for very long. You know, so it's like a little paradise bubble with lots of food. But the ants hate the spider, and they're always chasing it around. So it's kind of a blessing and a curse at the same time.
Wow. So they can't gang up on the spider enough to keep it away.
Well, remember, these spiders, as your other guest was saying, their vision is astonishing. So long before the ants see the spider sees the ants coming and just like hops to the next leaf.
Wow.
And, of course, if it really gets cornered, spiders have a trick up their sleeve, if you will. They can hang from silk. And the ants can look over the edge of the leaf and curse it, you know, but they can't get at it as it's hanging there.
It's a great story. This is an amazing spider. Are these spiders, can we see them? How do we find them? Now I want to go find them, because I've seen tiny little spiders crawling around without webs, because as you say, they don't create a web. Where can we find them?
Well, I'm sure Paul has an answer for that, too. Go ahead.
You know, the place that I always look is actually just on the sides of buildings. You can find a lot of spiders, a lot of jumping spiders, just sort of any kind of warm day in the summer, spring, or even into the fall. Because, you know, they sort of any building where you have like a lawn that goes up to a building, just because it makes for this big flat space that's very easy for them to find prey on.
Mm-hmm.
That's the easy answer. I'm sure that Eric has a much more impressive tropical answer.
No, I mean, tropical or anywhere else, if you're in a little wooded area or like the margin of a forest where it meets the fields, just take an umbrella and a stick and hold the umbrella upside down and beat the bushes so stuff falls into the umbrella, and you'll find jumping spiders. They're hiding away in the foliage and looking for prey. One little anecdote I love is that the Chinese word for jumping spider is fly tiger. So it translates that way into English, you know. So you'll figure out which ones are jumping spiders pretty easily if you look closely at those eyes.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. Talking with Paul Shamble and Eric Olson about these amazing jumping spiders. Now, Eric, I understand that the jumping spiders like to get up close and personal with aphids. Is that correct?
Well, so there are some other cases of plant feeding by spiders, and this took a lot of us by surprise just how common this is, but my co-author, Martin Neifeller from Switzerland, in a paper that he really was the lead author on recently, he did a massive literature review and contacted spiderologists from all around the world, and he collected scores of examples. And one really quirky one is that spiders will sometimes visit these colonies of aphids that are feeding on plant liquid saps. And the sap is a really crummy, nutrient-poor food. And so the aphid passes a lot of the liquid through its body, kind of filters out the nitrogen. And it drips this honeydew, it's basically, you know, sugar water, out the end of its tail. And the spiders will sometimes imbibe that. Anyway, it's a weird visual, but that's what they're doing.
They're drinking juice out of the butt of an aphid is what you're saying.
Basically, just plain straight talk. That's what they're doing. That's right. And they'll also visit nectar, you know, in the flowers. And on some plants, there are even extra floral nectars. They're really designed, we think, to attract ants. But once again, the jumping spiders will jump in and take that nectar. Well, so these are plant products, you know, nectars and so on. And spiders are taking them.
Let me go quickly to a question from Chris in Geneva, New York. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Ira. How are you?
Fine. Go ahead.
See, listen, I happen to be lucky enough to have myrmecomorph jumping spiders in my backyard. So these are jumping spiders that try to look like ants. And the question I have, since they don't seem to be associated with the ant colonies that are in my backyard, why do they walk around on their six hind legs and pretend to use their front two legs as antenna if they're not trying to fool the ants? Are they trying to fool wasps who might prey on them?
Good question. I didn't know they do that, Eric and Paul.
So I'll try a stab at that one. So ants sting. You know, a lot of ants have a stinger. And not all ants, but a lot of them that jumping spiders mimic are, if a bird grabs it, they might get a sting right next to the eye, you know. So I think in many cases it's an effort to hide. And some of the ants that they were particularly fond of mimicking are really kind of solitary hunters. And so, yeah, I don't really think they're trying to fool the ants. There are some jumping spiders that eat ants. It's not unheard of.
Well, why are they trying to mimic an ant then?
Well, do you mind if I take a stab?
Yeah, go ahead.
I got about a minute left. Go ahead.
Sure. This is actually this was the other half of my PhD thesis at Cornell. I'm not surprised that you have these out there in Geneva. There are a couple different species of jumping spiders, even just in upstate New York and sort of the Northeast, that do this. And just like Eric explained, it seems like, especially in these cases, it is a case of what's called Batesian mimicry. It's that if you're a generalist predator out there and you just want to eat little tiny bugs, you tend to really not want to eat ants because they taste terrible, they have angry friends, they sting, they bite, and spiders are delicious. So if you can fool everybody, then
there you go.
Great lessons on jumping spiders. This is a weekend project for all of us. Thank you, Paul Chambly, a John Harvard Distinguished Science Fellow at Harvard, and Eric Olson, Senior Lecturer in Ecology at Brandeis in Massachusetts. We're going to take a break and talk about a new drug test about possibly narrowing down what causes Alzheimer's. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. The amyloid hypothesis sounds like the title of a great mystery novel, doesn't it? Well, it's not a book yet, but it does have something to do with a mystery. The mystery of what causes Alzheimer's disease. Scientists know that a substance called beta amyloid and the protein tau both build up in the brains of people with Alzheimer's. But they don't really know which one is responsible for the cognitive decline and the memory loss that comes with the disease. The theory that beta amyloid is the true culprit is what's known as the amyloid hypothesis. But now a new drug being developed by Merck is getting ready to test this theory. It's already been shown to limit the formation of beta amyloid in mice and monkeys. And if it proves effective on people in a big phase 3 trial next year, it could help clear up this mystery. With us to discuss this are my guests, Matthew Kennedy, Director of Neuroscience at Merck, and Allison Goat, Director of the Loeb Center for Alzheimer's Disease at Mount Sinai. She joins us by Skype. Both to you. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira.
Thank you, Ira.
Great to be here with you.
Nice to have you both. Matthew, so this drug has been shown to limit the formation of beta amyloid in mice and monkeys. What? Tell me again, is the point of doing that?
Yeah, so this data in our new paper reflects the investment of almost 16 years worth of work to discover this drug, varibasestat. It really, it's a comprehensive summary of the preclinical and the early clinical phase 1 safety and activity data that we used to make the decision to progress varibasestat into two late-stage pivotal phase 3 trials. And those trials are actually being running in two different types of Alzheimer's disease patients, in mild to moderate patients. These are patients with frank symptoms, and also in a type of Alzheimer's that's now called prodromal Alzheimer's disease. So these are people at very early stages of the disease. And our first trial in mild to moderate patients is actually planning to be read out in 2017.
Mm-hmm. Allison, how will this, if it pans out to be true, how will this narrow down what causes Alzheimer's?
I think that this will provide evidence that the amyloid hypothesis is correct, and that drugs that are targeted to prevent the buildup of this beta amyloid peptide could be successful in treating disease. And as Matthew just pointed out, it's going to be important to look both in the early stage of the disease and in later stages of disease, because earlier studies have demonstrated that this amyloid peptide accumulates in the brain over probably a 15-year period, and this is a period before we see any clinical symptoms. So it might be important to use these kinds of drugs in people even before they show symptoms, if we can identify that they have that amyloid accumulation. So this is going to be very important to look in these two separate patient populations.
Were you actually able to tell that there is no amyloid in the patients if the drug works out, Matthew?
Yeah, we do actually have very good tests that allow us now to be able to see the amyloid in the brains of living patients. And these tests are called amyloid PET tracer tests. And these use an actual small molecule that's radiolabeled that can be given to patients in very small quantities. And it enters into the brain and binds to the amyloid plaque. So we can actually measure how much is there in that way. And we can look at that over time, and we're actually using that tracer in our trials. In fact, our second trial that's in the very early stages of Alzheimer's disease, the prodromal AD patients, that's actually a criteria to get into the trial. These are individuals that if you knew them well, you actually wouldn't be able to tell that they had a memory problem. But they do score very slightly with some cognitive impairment on very sensitive tests. But they also are scanned for the presence of amyloid in the brain. And so all of the patients that are being treated with varibasestat in that trial do, in fact, have amyloid plaque deposition in their brain.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Goh, what does beta amyloid do in the brains of normal people, normal patients?
So this is an important question, Ira, that we really don't know the answer to. People have been studying. So this beta amyloid peptide is produced from a precursor that was identified now some 30 years ago. But we really don't know either the normal function of the precursor protein or whether beta amyloid itself has any specific function. And this has been difficult to find out because there are a couple of other very similar proteins that are called APP-like proteins that have some functional overlap probably with APP. And so as a result, we don't know for sure whether there is any function for that beta amyloid fragment that's being produced.
I find it interesting that we hear so much talk about the causes of Alzheimer's, but the more I talk to researchers like Dr. Kennedy and Dr. Goh, to both of you, it seems like you really don't know a whole lot about what's going on in the brain there. Would that be overstating something?
I think so. I mean, I think we could say that we've actually learned a huge amount in the last 30 years since we discovered APP and mutations in APP that cause Alzheimer's disease. But it's certainly true that we still have a lot to learn. But I think that this study and others are really getting us closer towards testing this hypothesis and seeing whether these BACE inhibitors might actually be useful therapies. Mm-hmm.
Dr. Kennedy, what are the questions that still remain for this drug that you're testing?
Yeah, so the major question that we're asking right now is, will varibasestat at the doses that we're using that create very large reductions in the synthesis of this A-beta peptide that should impair the ability of the plaques to continue to grow and be formed, will this level of inhibition of A-beta synthesis actually bring cognitive benefit to patients? And that's the big question. And our project actually really focused as hard as it could, really, to efficiently bring this molecule forward to patients. So it's a bit unusual for us to move directly from our phase 1 study into this large phase 3 study. But actually, as a drug discoverer, varibasestat represents really the best kind of molecule you'd want to be able to bring forward. It has sort of an unambiguous effect on the activity of this key enzyme. So it's going to allow us to ask a very clear question in patients. And independent of what the outcome is next summer of this first trial, whether it be positive or not, we're going to be able to use that data, and the whole field will use that data, I think, to be able to redirect the clinical space and focus either on much earlier stage patients, as we're doing in our second trial, which we'll find out about the next year, and also begin to think about how we could bring more treatments that we're currently working on the labs against, say, for instance, the tau protein that you mentioned, because it is a very complex disease.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Goh, so in your mind, if this drug does work, does it prove the amyloid hypothesis is correct?
I think it would. I think that it would be demonstrating directly that if you lower the beta amyloid levels, that you can prevent the onset of Alzheimer's disease, and that is one of the predictions of the amyloid hypothesis. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that other things might not also be important, but it certainly demonstrates the importance of that amyloid peptide.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Kennedy, when will we expect to see whether it's working or not?
Well, there have been well over 1,000 individuals that have actually been dosed with varibasestat up to this point for up to a year. And next summer will be the point where we'll learn in July the outcome of the first trial in mild to moderate patients. Then about a year or so later, we'll determine the outcome of the trial for prodromal patients. So we're very excited to learn those results next year.
Well, we'll be watching along with you. I want to thank you both for taking time to be with us today. Matthew Kennedy, Director of Neuroscience at Merck, and Allison Goat, Director of the Loeb Center for Alzheimer's Disease at Mount Sinai here in New York. Thanks again for taking time to be with us.
Thank you very much, Ira.
That sound means it's time for a meeting of the Science Club. And here to check in on our latest project, Break It Down, here to talk about it, are the founding members of the Science Club. Our education manager, Ariel Zitch, joining us via Skype, and Science Friday's director, Charles Berquist, here at our CUNY studios. Welcome back. Let me begin with you, Charles.
Thanks, Ira.
How's it going?
It's going great. You know, we've been working on this for about a week. We started it last week when we were actually out in St. Louis. And the project this time is we're challenging people to learn something about how something works, what's inside something, by looking, breaking it apart and looking at the parts that are inside.
Mm-hmm. And Ariel, last week we were in St. Louis and we broke down floppy disks and keyboards, and boy, did the crowd love that.
It was incredible. It was awesome. You could hear all the pieces.
Let's take a listen.
I highly recommend taking your little metallic thing off, right? This is called a shutter. Ooh, listen to that. I can hear everybody's shutters getting popped off.
The sounds of things breaking. Isn't that joy to
something? Yeah, and you might, if you're lucky, you might catch the spring that flies out of there if you don't have a spring.
So Ariel, who should be doing this? What sorts of stuff have you received so far that's been breaking down?
Well, so everybody should try this. That satisfaction you get when you open something up to see how it works on the inside, that's the feeling we want you to have. Everybody does that. Scientists do it. Geologists do it. Biologists do it. So please, everybody participate. I think we've already gotten a ton of submissions of people breaking down their pens, right? Because the clicky pen thing is this like very easy thing to break down. I think we can go way beyond that. So break down your vegetables, break down your cereal. We actually have a bunch of ideas on our website right now at sciencefriday.com. You can find a whole bunch of things that you can break down in less than 10 minutes. But also be ambitious. Go through that old junk drawer you have and find something to break down. I think really there aren't many limits. Am I right, Charles?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, use common sense. Use safety. Please don't take apart anything that's plugged in. Don't take apart anything that's still alive or that you or somebody you love cares deeply about.
Safety glasses.
Safety glasses if you have them. You know, be aware that some things might have stuff in them that you don't want to get on your hands. Everybody's got that old VCR sitting around in the garage or that thing that your uncle left you that you don't know what it is. Take a look inside.
Do we want them to send it to us?
Well, we certainly do.
We want all those VCRs.
Well, no, we don't want the physical VCR. You know, there's electronics recycling firms that take care of that.
Glad we got that out of the way.
Yeah, you can send that to Ira's house. But at sciencefriday.com/scienceclub, we've got a nice form where you can tell us about what you're breaking down, what's inside. Or if you're doing these things on the social web, you can share it with us. The hashtag is IBrokeItDown.
I won't be home for the next few weeks, so don't send it to me. Let me just let everybody know this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. And I am Ira Flato talking with Ariel Zitch and Charles Berquist about our Break It Down. And so you would say then, Charles, it's been successful. We've had a very successful time so far.
So far. I mean, we're only a week in. We're going to be doing this through December 9th. So if you've got some downtime this weekend, next weekend, over the Thanksgiving break, we've got plenty of time for you to explore and share your discoveries with us.
And Ariel, have you gone through some of the stuff that's been coming in?
So I have, and I love what I'm seeing so far, which is even scientists are participating. So we had some folks from the University of Minnesota. They showed us an exploded diagram of their microreactor where they used to study chemical reactions. Exploded diagrams are a great way of breaking something down, but so are those chemical reactions.
So they didn't physically explode anything.
No,
just the diagram.
But most explosions are actually decomposition reactions, so that totally counts. Be safe, kids, but really, explosions are great chemistry and are an example of breaking something down. So there's really no kind of subject bounds to this challenge. I think what's so exciting about it is, you can break down technology. You can also, like, break down, I don't know, your juice or break down your shoes or try to break down some concept that they've always struggled with by like taking something complex apart. That's the whole point of this. So mm-hmm. really go to town.
Yeah, and if you're looking for some ideas, Ariel's put together a great collection of 6 easy things that you can break down yourself right now within, you know, 10, 15 minutes after getting off the air. You can start this, but don't limit it to that. Use that as a jumping off point to get your destructive explanatory juices flowing.
Inspiration, exactly. And bring a friend along for the ride. I think one of the things that we found when we did this in St. Louis was people who like got a keyboard to break down were looking at the person with the floppy disk like, oh my gosh, I didn't know that was in a floppy disk. And the person with the floppy disk was like, I've never seen the inside of a keyboard before. So part of the fun of this challenge is sharing it with other yeah. people. And that's one of the reasons why we have that hashtag, the I broke it down hashtag, so that people can really kind of get into that social sphere of exploring things with other people.
Kudos to you and Charles for finding enough old floppy disks still in existence. Did you have any trouble finding
that? That was our
area. How do you find floppy disks these days?
Well, electronics recyclers do this kind of thing all the time. So, and actually our video producer, Luke, made that great video about commingled recycling and how it's separated. That's a great example of how, of like an applicable break it down, right? So if you mm-hmm. take, you know, the challenge of recycling, which is there's a whole bunch of stuff all commingled together and you've got to get it separated, you can break those down by density, by weight, by great. Plastic, great. You know, all of that.
All right. Our education manager, Ariel Zitch, and Science Friday's director, Charles Berquist, founding members of the Science Friday Science Club. And that hashtag again is hashtag I broke it down. One last thing before we go. I'd like to take a moment to remember the molecular biologist Susan Lindquist. She was a pioneer in the study of protein folding and how it related to human disease, too. And she was here in 2006 talking about it on Science Friday.
Many really dreadful human diseases are due to proteins not taking their right shapes, to them folding into the wrong kind of a shape and then doing something bad. But these are really complicated, difficult diseases to study, and it's a difficult process to study. And I've been working on protein folding for a good many years now, and we've worked in lots of different organisms. And it turns out that the fungus, the yeast Saccharomyces cerevisiae, which is well known to you because it's the organism that produces the leavened bread and beer and wine.
Common yeast.
Common yeast. It's a wonderful workhorse in the laboratory.
Biologist Susan Lindquist of MIT, her studies on that laboratory workhorse yeast went on to provide important insights into diseases like Parkinson's and many, many others. She passed away in Boston last week at the age of 67. That's all the time we have this hour. Charles Berquist is our director, our senior producer, Christopher Intagliata. Our producers are Alexa Lim, Annie Minoff, Christy Taylor, Katie Heiler. Luke Groskin is our video producer. Rich Kim, our technical director. Sarah Fishman and Jack Horowitz are our engineers at the controls here at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.